A foremost authority on world energy issues, Dr. Pinner is with the UC San Diego Center for Energy Research.
The lecture is Steps Towards the Hydrogen Economy, and hopefully we'll get that hooked up and turned on very quickly now. I started to talk about this particular subject many years ago, and this is really the fifth lecture in this sequence. And the paper that I left in front is a scientific publication which is currently in press. That means it's being published in a journal. The journal is Energy, the International Journal. Now, the first time I talked about this was at Porto Venere in Italy about 4 years ago. It was a lecture on a meeting on energy, ecology, and economics. And that's worth keeping in mind, because any energy topic in some very real sense bears on these three major issues, ecology and economics as well as energy. Now, my second lecture on this was put on the internet for use by high school and grade school teachers involved in grades K through 12. And that was quite a challenge to put it in such a way that it was intelligible at that level. The third exposure was about a year ago at General Atomics, where we discussed the question of how to make hydrogen cheaply using nuclear reactors. And in between, there were a few other discussions. Now, let me say a couple of things in general about this topic. I'm talking about the hydrogen economy not because we are about to run out of fossil fuels. If you read even the journal Science, where the editor has a long history of being opposed to anything useful or beneficial to the use of fossil fuels, you will find that within the last 2 months there was a paper there from an Italian engineer in which he indicated that our known reserves of fossil fuels, meaning petroleum, have increased by 50% according to our most recent estimate. Very different story from the one that we are imminently running out of low-cost fuels. And if you include in an assessment of this sort other energy sources like shale oil or the tar sands, it's quite clear that fossil energy is abundant enough to take care of all of our needs for at least another 500 years. So the impetus for the hydrogen economy is certainly not that we are running out of energy. What is the reason for our interest in hydrogen? Well, that goes back a very long way. There are many reasons. One of the reasons is that it's a subject that we've been talking about literally for 240 years scientifically. And that's a short time period, because there is a new encyclopedia of energy that was just published, and one of the authors in there talked about the history of hydrogen, and he's got a 500-year history of hydrogen. But that includes about 260 years of not quite knowing what hydrogen is. So I'm going to begin my history with the discovery and isolation of hydrogen. That's one of the reasons. It's been around, and we've talked about, or many people have talked about, the possibility of using hydrogen as a fuel. The attraction of using hydrogen is painfully clear. It's painfully clear because it is a fuel which, in principle, we can make by dissociating water, and water is very abundant. Let me continue with a discussion of why hydrogen. It would be wonderful to have a fuel that could be made from water. It could be made from renewable energy. When we dissociate water, what do we get? We get hydrogen and oxygen. And then we could use the hydrogen and burn it. And what do we get when we burn hydrogen? We get water back. And this is a very appealing idea, because the resource base is essentially unlimited, and the overall impact, if it's done properly, elegantly, would not disturb anything. That idea has been around for a very long time, as I said, and I will go through the history in just a moment, because the overall view of the history is kind of interesting and very informative, in the sense that you will see how our more advanced scientific discoveries bear on what we are trying to do in this sector. There are some very mundane reasons why we want that kind of a fuel source. One of them is that if we burn hydrogen in an environment where there is very heavy traffic, for example, we don't make any particulates, and therefore the environmental impact will be greatly reduced. So hydrogen looks like a great fuel from that perspective. And finally, of course, and I don't want to be quoted as being either strongly concerned or completely oblivious to the arguments about global warming. There are other people here who know much more about this than I do, and they will illuminate that topic. But it does figure in this attempt to develop the hydrogen economy. The most recent impetus came from President Bush, who announced as a matter of policy that we wanted to develop a hydrogen energy base. Al Gore never claimed to have invented the hydrogen economy. That's also useful. The hydrogen economy, depending on your perspective, you could argue that it was invented by Jules Verne, a well-known science fiction writer. We'll go look at that. And then, to my amazement, I read in another overview of hydrogen, that's a new encyclopedia of energy, which was just published. I'm reviewing the whole thing, so I started out by reading the chapters on hydrogen. And there the author says that the term hydrogen economy was invented at General Motors. I know the author of that statement very well. He served on a committee that I chaired some years ago. And then I remembered I was a General Motors consultant for 20 years, and at the end of that time I was convinced that everything had been invented at General Motors, including babies. So with that, let's go look at the issues of a hydrogen economy. The material on the view graphs is generally speaking for my benefit and not generally required for you. I have the same problem that the earlier speaker had, a slightly failing memory, and then these little jogs are very helpful. The first question is, can you use hydrogen safely? Why are we concerned about that? Because we all suffer from the Hindenburg syndrome, which you may remember, the explosion at Lakehurst, that's part of my history. And so we want to be sure that when we have the hydrogen and have it cheaply, we can use it without blowing ourselves up. And here are some brief comments on that issue. The hydrogen, I'm going to compare it with natural gas. I'm comparing it with natural gas because I'm primarily interested in the transportation sector. Obviously, that's the high-value entry for hydrogen as a fuel. And I'm interested in the transportation sector for that reason, and because that also puts a tremendous stress on our economy. We want to replace the oil that is imported as soon as possible, if we can do it at acceptable cost. Natural gas has been used extensively as a transportation fuel in Italy and in New Zealand. And we have a great deal of experience on how hazardous a tank of natural gas in the trunk might be. We got field experience from all the Americans driving around New Zealand on the wrong side of the street and producing a sufficient number of collisions so that we got some field tests that are meaningful. And they showed that nothing ever happened, that the natural gas tank was completely safe. And on that basis, I would argue that hydrogen should be completely safe, although hydrogen is more easily ignited than natural gas, and it's much more apt to produce an explosive mixture with air. Hydrogen is much lighter than natural gas, and for that reason it diffuses away from a source much more rapidly than natural gas. And that compensates for the increased hazard associated with easy ignitability and explosibility. And as a result of that kind of an argument, I would say it should be like natural gas. With natural gas, we have great experience, and therefore it should be reasonably safe. And also we have, from the automotive industry, some recent tests with hydrogen-filled tanks. like dropping them and doing all kinds of things like that, which again indicate that it is unlikely to be more hazardous than natural gas and would be quite a safe fuel. That's really only a preliminary statement, because when it gets into the transportation sector, with all of us driving as recklessly as most of us do, God only knows what kind of new things we will discover. But in the meantime, I think we can be comfortable that a reasonably constructed program of introducing hydrogen energy is quite feasible. Big steps in that direction were taken by our distinguished governor, who filled up one of his four Hummers, I understand, at the University of California, Irvine, with hydrogen not very long ago. And of course, you can't trust news broadcasts, but one of those people, or maybe several of them, that I heard were talking about he taking one of his Hummers and sending it to General Motors to convert to a hybrid using a fuel cell engine for the hybrid vehicle. These are all to the good. I mean, getting started like that certainly can't hurt. And that's why we call our governor in California very often our governator. You probably have heard that. Now, what on earth is going on here? It's fine.
Let me help you real quick here. Okay. You may want to use that.
Well, it's fine. Well, let's look at the hydrogen history. The first four entries here are the scientific hydrogen history. When was hydrogen first made? In 1766, nearly 240 years ago. That's a long time. And it was identified as hydrogen. It was made in a normal way by reacting iron with sulfuric acid. And the great French scientist Lavoisier, 15 years or so later, introduced the term hydrogen for maker of water, and that's stuck ever since. Then I'm jumping to 1929, when Hartek in the U.S. identified hydrogen as having two primary components. Actually, there are three components, but two primary components. And then in 1931, Harold Urey of our university, the late Harold Urey, and his colleagues isolated one of the two isotopes that make up hydrogen, namely deuterium. He got the Nobel Prize for that work. I said this is the scientific summary. And finally, in 1935, Lord Rutherford isolated tritium, the third component of the third element in normal hydrogen. That's the end of the scientific history. Now we're going to look at the engineering history. The engineering history also began very early. It began in 1820 with the Reverend Cecil, who built something like an engine. I just call it a vacuum engine. I don't have time to describe that in detail. But it's a good thing to realize that the idea of using hydrogen in an engine goes back to 1820. A monumental discovery was made in 1839 by W.R. Grove, an English scientist. I have in heavy print the discoveries that I consider to be most important in terms of developing hydrogen as a fuel for transportation. And this discovery of the fuel cell in 1839 was an enormous step forward. It was an enormous step forward for the following reason. When we burn gasoline or hydrogen in an engine, the maximum efficiency that we can get is determined by a fundamental law of science, the second law of thermodynamics. And that, in turn, gives us an efficiency that is bounded by the highest temperature we can have and the lowest temperature we can have. Now, the highest temperature we can have is obviously limited by materials. And when we use that temperature together with room temperature, which will normally be the lowest temperature in an operating engine, we come out with very low fundamental limits to efficiency. Efficiency is on the order of 20%. You can't do any better than that. The laws of physics don't allow it. Now, in a fuel cell, the story is completely different, because now we have an electrochemical conversion of hydrogen electrochemical oxidation of hydrogen to water, and there is no such limit imposed by the laws of physics. In other words, the efficiency in principle can now be 100%. That, in a nutshell, is the reason why the discovery of the fuel cell marks a milestone in our efforts to improve efficiency in transportation and in energy use. And that is why I have it in heavy print there as a significant discovery that put us on the road to the fuel cell-powered hydrogen vehicles. Otto, of internal combustion engine fame, as far back as the 1870s, was experimenting with mixtures of hydrogen and fuel, normal fuels. So the idea of mixing those two up and making a new fuel is pretty old, really. We've tried it, and it works, and there's no problem with it. And the inventor of the internal combustion engine was doing this in 1870. That's also a good few years ago. The next step in the fuel cell development was by Mond and Langer in England. And fuel cells are not single cells. By the time you have a fuel cell system, you might have hundreds or thousands of these. And the prototype fuel cell of the modern type was invented in 1890. And now I come to a very important chapter again in the development of fuel cell energy. And this is a lecture given in 1894 by the great German scientist Ostwald. He was speaking to the German Society for Science and Engineering, to the thermodynamicists of that era. And he gave a very simple lecture. He said that it is a scandal the way we get efficiencies of around 10% in our best engines. And if we had a fuel cell, it would be 100%. And it was sort of a call to arms. Build fuel cell-powered systems. And there were many papers published that followed this discussion by Ostwald. Now we come to near-modern times. The top entry here I regard as a milestone again because it is very popular in the current literature. The Scottish engineer, Haldane, advocated producing hydrogen by decomposing water by electrolysis and thereby making hydrogen and then using that hydrogen in an engine. And what that boils down to is the suggestion to use renewable energy to make hydrogen and then have our fuel. And you don't have to look very far at the current literature to see abundant evidence of people coming up, incidentally, with this very same idea, or they are burning biomass or something of that sort. So the idea of a renewable energy source decomposing water to get the hydrogen is, again, very old. Well, then the normal sort of things an abnormal thing happened in 1937 when the 10th flight of the Hindenburg Zeppelin ended in disaster, and we were all told that was because hydrogen formed an explosive mixture with air. But that is very much in doubt today because there were other chemicals on board that probably were responsible for the ignition and the explosion of the Hindenburg Zeppelin. And with that, I hope that your Hindenburg complex will rest, and you won't have problems with that one. I'm indicating that Sikorsky, in 1938, used hydrogen for helicopter power, and fuel cells began commercial entry, if you can call it that, in the 1950s in connection with the space program. So the fuel cells have been around. This is not the kind of a fuel cell. An AFC is an alkaline fuel cell. It's not the kind of a fuel cell that we would use in the automotive sector. I also have a little bit of a personal history here. In 1967, I was at a meeting of the International Petroleum Institute in Mexico City. And I wasn't there because I was talking about anything relating to hydrogen or fuel cells. I was there because I was involved had been involved for some years on the shale oil recovery program. But during this meeting, F.D. Rossini, who was then director of the precursor to NIST, the National Bureau of Standards, NIST is the National Institute for Science and Technology in Washington, gave a very interesting lecture on the science of fuel cells, in which he pointed out especially that we were not really quite limited to 100% efficiency. We could do a little bit better, provided the reaction was a reaction of a type that cooled the system so that we would get some heat transferred from the environment to the system, and then we could even go a little bit over 100%. That was an interesting topic. It really has very little to do with the engineering development. When did I use the hydrogen economy phrase for the first time? Well, looking back in 1975, when Iserman and I published our three-volume series on energy, we had a chapter in there. The chapter was called The Hydrogen Economy, Alternative Fuels. It was the longest chapter in the book. So that, you can see, you can judge that the preoccupation, even at the academic level, with this idea is not very new. During 1984 and 85, I had the privilege of serving as chairman of a DOE international group to look at fuel cells and what the scientific issues were that needed to be clarified in order to advance the technology. That was 1984-85. In 1994-95, 10 years later, I was given the same assignment, but this time looking at commercialization of fuel cells. We had an international group. We traveled all over the globe, and it became very clear to me and to the people on my committee that we couldn't cover the automotive sector, because as soon as we started to talk about fuel cells in transportation in Japan or in Germany or anywhere else, the hosts clammed up. We couldn't get any information. Fortunately, the California Air Resources Board subsequently set up a group on fuel cells for automobile engines, and that study was 96 to 98, and Fritz Kullhammer from the Electric Power Research Institute was chairman of that, and that group did a wonderful job of defining the commercialization issues for automotive use. And that's certainly something that we want to be aware of. And last year, there was a major panel discussion in Detroit. A.K. Oppenheim served as chairman, and the discussion was hydrogen for fuel cells in transportation systems. Now, I think I somehow lost in here a very important entry. Well, it's too much science and not enough goodwill here. There is a book published by Jules Verne in the 1860s, where he has a beautiful little paragraph that says, "Water will be the future fuel as coal is now. We will decompose water into hydrogen and oxygen and then burn it, and it will be inexhaustible and clean." That's Jules Verne in the 1860s. End of history. Now we have to do something scientific, a little bit scientific. What is the hydrogen economy anyway? The hydrogen economy is defined as an industrial system in which the universal energy carriers are hydrogen and electricity. Of course, electricity is a wonderful energy carrier, and much of our economy depends on its current use and applications for any and all purposes. And hydrogen is oxidized to water that may be reused by applying an external energy source to break up the water and get the hydrogen back. That, in a nutshell, is the hydrogen economy. Now, how many different hydrogen economies can you envision? Well, there has to be an energy source to break up the water. And you can, in principle, envision as many hydrogen economies as there are techniques for dissociating water. It could be an economy based on the use of fuel cells, of conventional fuels. How do we make hydrogen today? We only make it from natural gas and other fossil fuels. It's very expensive that way. It's not made for transportation. It's made for upgrading petroleum. It's got high value use. It costs about, per unit of energy, five times as much as the gasoline you buy. And therefore, using that approach, starting with fossil fuels, is not a likely near-term approach. It's just too expensive. The fossil fuels, of course, come in many shades: coal, petroleum, natural gas, shale oil, oil from tar sands, or natural gas from geopressured locations, all of that stuff. That would be one way, then, of getting the energy that we need to break up the water. Another way would be nuclear reactors, including fission and breeder reactors, and ultimately fusion reactors. That is the long-term view. That is also not economical now. I'll have a few more words to say about that. And finally, which the purists certainly like best, is to start out with Haldane's idea, using a renewable source like the wind to make the hydrogen, to make electricity and then make hydrogen, or using hydroelectric power systems. Well, what's wrong with those? All of those are more or less already in use, and electricity is every bit as good an energy carrier as hydrogen, so that would be no improvement to go from electricity to hydrogen. There are many people, or the geothermal resources, are sort of in the same category. They're already fully used. Then there are the whole host of solar conversion technologies, starting with biomass production, photovoltaic energy conversion, solar thermal systems, any of these. And finally, I have listed there ocean thermal energy conversion systems, because at the end of this lecture, when I'm going to talk about near-term possibilities, I have to give very high marks to that system, which depends on the temperature difference in the tropical oceans between the top layer and the water a few hundred feet down. And that temperature difference is large enough to run an electric system. And the electric system gives us the energy that we need to dissociate water into hydrogen and oxygen. But since we're in the tropical ocean, we can't ship that hydrogen at acceptable cost to the land. So we have to have one more step. We take the hydrogen we make that way, and with nitrogen from the atmosphere, convert it into ammonia, and we can ship the ammonia, easily compressed, easily liquefied, all over the globe. And in many ways, if you want a near-term system that on paper looks as though it is competitive now, that's the system. That's one of them, anyway. Okay, so there are these three different hydrogen technologies. This is a statement about cost. I said that when you start to talk about energy, you're talking about three topics all the time. You're talking about the energy part, you're talking about the ecology part, and you're talking about economics. And the economics are pretty dismal right now. We do not know how to make hydrogen, or it has not been demonstrated that we know how to make hydrogen for energy use for anything less than about five times what we have been paying with $40 a barrel oil. That gets to be very expensive. That is, there is an economic barrier that we have yet to overcome. This is an example of a hydrogen economy, the way it might function. This one functions all right, but it would be economically unacceptable. This is one that was discussed at length last year at General Atomics. At General Atomics, the people there, of course, are all builders of nuclear reactors. They have these nuclear reactors, and they want to make some money from the nuclear reactors. Well, they make money by generating electricity. And they figured out that if natural gas costs went a little higher than they were at the time of the conference, and considerably lower than they've been during the last few months, that the hydrogen made with nuclear energy would be competitive with the hydrogen in the market now. But you have to remember, the hydrogen in the market now is not for transportation. That's a high-value chemical. So that we are not talking about a hydrogen economy in the true sense there. Economically, we can only make money for the nuclear reactor people if they make some hydrogen at a cost lower than the current market cost. And that seems to be roughly the case. Otherwise, from the transportation perspective, this simply doesn't work. It's too costly. But you can see from here what this hydrogen economy looks like. There's a nuclear reactor. The nuclear reactor gives us electricity in generating stations in the conventional way. We can make hydrogen with nuclear energy by what are called sequential chemical reactions. I'll summarize that very briefly. That gets to be somewhat scientific when we talk about that. So we have the hydrogen underground. We can compress it, liquefy it, store it, whatever we want to do. And we can also, since we get the electricity by another route from the nuclear reactor, we can produce hydrogen by electrolysis. So we can fill the pipelines this way. The costs are not acceptable. Once we have the hydrogen and we have a built-up hydrogen economy, then we use hydrogen in the home. Hopefully we'll learn how to build safe stoves with hydrogen. That's the job I wouldn't want to have just yet, I think. Maybe later, but not just yet. We would use it industrially as we do now. We would use it for transportation in fuel cell systems, as described by Kallhammer's group, and we would use it for electricity generation at local stations. And there you can see this is a true hydrogen economy because the independent energy source is the nuclear reactor and everything else is done either with electricity or with hydrogen. Well, now this is somewhat complicated, but if you focus on the bottom line, it's really not complicated. What are we doing? We're taking water and making hydrogen and oxygen out of it. I put this up as a historical document. Cesare Marchetti, he worked at ISPRA in Italy in 1970. He came up with the idea of forming the hydrogen by running sequential chemical reactions, some of them involving very nasty materials like mercury and bromine, you know, just the kind of stuff you don't want to play with. I invited him to come to our university as a Regents lecturer to talk about these novel experiments, but something happened between the time I invited him and the time he came. He was elected to the Papal Academy of Science, and when he came, he was only interested in talking on how we could feed 12 billion people comfortably on the planet. So it didn't quite work out that the way I had planned it. But this was a pioneering experiment. And last year when we talked at General Atomics, we were talking about improved systems of this sort. And all you have to remember about these sequential systems is that everything in between is used, transformed, reused, transformed. And when you look at it all up, the only thing you're doing is you're splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. This type of work is still current in many places. Here are two cycles that are used in Japan. They involve, you know, sort of tolerable material, iodine, which we used to put on our wounds before we discovered that there were better things, and calcium and bromine. The bromine is not a very happy compound. Again, if you add all these up, the only thing we're doing is we're splitting water. This is a chart. This is a summary of the General Atomic Meeting of a year ago. And what the organizer of the meeting has shown is that when the natural gas costs go up to a little more than $3 per million BTU, that's $3 per 1,000 cubic feet, where they are, they're way above that now, then the nuclear process will become a cheaper source of hydrogen than the conventional way, but still far too expensive for transportation. The next three slides deal with a somewhat esoteric topic that I don't think I'll attempt to describe beyond saying the following. In About 1972, a couple of Japanese investigators, Fujishima and Honda, published a very fascinating paper in which they proposed and gave data on the use of a semiconductor exposed to sunlight, producing in an electrochemical system hydrogen and oxygen from water. Now that, of course, is the ultimate renewable approach, if it works. Their efficiencies were quite low. And this idea, during the many years since 1972, that's 32 years already, has been worked over all over the globe in every laboratory. And if you want to read about a current new discovery in this field, just look at Science under water photolysis. And there are claims that we are on the verge of making this system workable and acceptable. This would be a great way to go. I mean, that would be wonderful, that if all you need to do is build a cell up on top here, and the H nu that's coming in on top is sunlight, and you have a semiconductor there, the titanium dioxide, and on a base, on a metal base, and platinum on the other side, and you're running an electrochemical cell, you're dissociating water, you're making hydrogen, and you're making oxygen from sunlight directly. The efficiencies are still too low for anything like a market entry. This, in my opinion, is the preferred way to go towards the hydrogen economy. It may, in fact, be the only way that will work in the end at economically acceptable costs. Well, what about introduction of hydrogen into the economy? Well, we already have about 2% of the energy that we have in petroleum products in hydrogen in use in our economy now for specialty purposes, not for transportation. We have run, or large companies have run, trucks and buses on liquefied hydrogen. There's a big difference between a bus and a truck on the one hand and a small car on the other hand. On a big thing like a bus or a truck, you have the room to put a hydrogen refrigeration system, and then you can use liquid hydrogen as the source. And the Ballard truck that was running around the West Coast and north of us too, well north of us, was built about 3 years ago, and it functioned beautifully. I took a ride in it. I even had a couple of minutes when I could drive it. It was fine. It was running like a car, like a truck, or like a bus. So for large-scale applications, the preferred fuel is likely to be liquefied hydrogen. For small-scale applications, we can't put liquefiers on small cars. We have a major storage problem, because if we put compressed tanks of hydrogen on the cars, our mileage will be severely limited, how far we can go. So severely limited that I don't think there's any chance of consumer acceptance, particularly with the new competition that these systems have now. The new competition being the hybrids. And let's see whether we can somehow connect these two. This refers to the entry of fuel cell powered systems. We already have commercially available today gasoline hybrids, which burn gasoline in an internal combustion engine and have a big battery on them, and as I'm sure you're aware, give very good performance in the transportation sector. I have had a car for over 2 years, and if I don't climb up and down the La Jolla Hills, I can easily get 50 miles per gallon on that car. That's already double what I used to get with almost any vehicle that I drove in the past. So that's a big step forward. The fuel cell vehicle has to compete with this hybrid system that is already in place. That hybrid system, if you have a full gas tank, will carry you 600 miles Now, that's nice, you know, because most of us are not very fond of sitting at a gas station and filling up. It's much more fun to drive and use the stuff. And in that sense, the small car with the fuel cell simply won't make it. I don't think cars like that are going to be saleable, even if the performance is better than with the hybrid. The performance will be better than with the hybrid in time, maybe. There was a split in the automotive community between the U.S. manufacturers and the foreign manufacturers, really. The U.S. manufacturers argued that because of the storage problem and because of the gasoline distribution system in place, the way to make fuel cell-powered vehicles was to start with gasoline on the car and then reprocess the gasoline on the vehicle and make the hydrogen that way and then use that hydrogen in the fuel cell with high efficiency. Sounded like a great idea, except that reprocessor turned out to be a chemical plant on a car. And that turned out to be a rather undesirable and inefficient way to go. And as of last year in Detroit, most of the people who talked about that approach said that they were not going to pursue it anymore, that they were giving up on carrying a conventional fuel and making the hydrogen on board. And that's probably a good bad idea to drop. Now let's look at this. This is sort of the final conclusion on fuel cells and hydrogen. What we have today in the hybrid systems are internal combustion engine battery hybrids. They're hybrids because there are two power movers in there. One is an internal combustion engine, and the other one is a battery system. And, of course, the competition with that, if it comes from a fuel cell system, would be a fuel cell battery hybrid, or maybe, and I again think that this isn't going to happen because it'll be too expensive, is a fuel cell internal combustion engine battery hybrid. You can do many things by putting more and more things together. One point that I ought to make is that if we switched over a period of 7 years to hybrid systems, we would save about 50% of the fuel energy in the transportation sector. And that 50% in the transportation sector would work out to be about 15% or so of total fuel use. And that would be far more than we were supposed to be doing under the Kyoto Agreement. So that the imperative for switching the transportation sector to something more efficient is really quite compelling. And it is cheap, and it is doable now. So I suspect that we will reduce our fossil fuel consumption very substantially, even if we just let normal market forces allow the penetration of the hybrid systems. Which there must be something to that story, because this is the first time I've owned a car for 2.5 years, and it's worth as much after 2.5 years as I paid for it. That's never happened before. Well, this is the end of this part. I do have another part. I have about 70 view graphs here that we can go through, but I don't think we really want to do that. So let me just make a few auxiliary comments that may help you understand this whole problem a little better. And I think for that purpose, I will go back to an overhead view graph. It's been 165 years since Grove invented the fuel cell. That's a fact. The replacement of an existing technology by a new entry requires costs that are generally 20 to 30% lower than the existing costs. We are very far from that. Very far from that. In fact, the costs on the fuel side will be at least 3 and maybe 5 times greater than the current costs. We have a distribution system in place for gasoline, for diesel fuel, for natural gas, and for other fossil fuels And if we can't do reprocessing on board, we are going to have to build that hydrogen distribution system that our governor talked about and is seriously proposing to implement in California. Of course, if we get the kind of range that we get with a hybrid system, we can fill up in Tijuana and drive all the way to Oregon, then we don't need to fill up in California at all. But that's a different system. The distribution system involving hydrogen will be enormously costly. I really don't have a number on this. I've seen numbers for just the state of California, and they are between $5 and $10 billion just for California. To do that countrywide, well, we are most of the country, but not really all of it, or even a very large fraction of it. So the total cost of putting that hydrogen system in place will be very, very large. And without that, there won't be a hydrogen economy in the transportation sector. And so there is a fundamental question that you want to ask yourself. Do you know of any other technology that was not introduced within the first 165 years of discovery on a significant scale? I don't know of anything like that, really. The fuel cell entry into the economic sector has been very, very slow. It's been accelerating during the last few decades because we learned facts about material science that we didn't know. So that, for example, the membranes that we need in fuel cells, which were very expensive, now cost a tiny fraction of what they cost even 20 years ago. So there may be some real progress on that. On the other hand, we don't have the low-cost hydrogen supply that I can see. And there's a fundamental question you want to ask yourself. Do you really want to go ahead now and proceed with changing our entire transportation sector when it is likely to fail? And if it fails, will that be for many, many more years the end of the idea of a fuel cell system in the transportation sector? That's a philosophical question that needs to be addressed. You don't want to be too early and you don't want to be too late. This is a business venture, after all. You've got to come in there at the right time when you have a chance to succeed. Well, I was going to give you some numbers, but they'll be too difficult to find for me now. I'll tell them to you as best as I remember them. To make a competitive vehicle, you have to compete with a very low-cost engine, an internal combustion engine. It costs about $3,000. So you've got $3,000 to play with if you want to be competitive. And where are you going to put that money? Well, you put $1,000 into the fuel cell system. Then you put $1,000 into the overall management system. And you put another $1,000 into the storage system. And that's all you've got. Because by that time, you're already overtaken by poor economics compared with an existing system. I don't know how this is going to come out. Certainly, Kalhammer and the people who looked at fuel cell hybrids for California were pretty optimistic that one could do this. And I would say that the optimism is totally justified on the fuel cell side, because there the progress has been sufficient so that we can build those systems today, or we think we can build them, for this $1,000 that we are talking about. The hang-up here is still the fuel supply system. I don't know how we are going to end up finally making low-cost hydrogen, or if we will ever make low-cost hydrogen. I was going to show a chart from a friend of mine at New York University by the name of Ruhl Shinar. He starts out, he has a wonderful title for his paper, "The Mirage of a Hydrogen Economy." That's the title. And he then goes on and talks about the $10 billion that was wasted on hydrogen during the 70s on these sequential chemical reactions involving nuclear reactors. But he's making a mistake there, I think, because the nuclear people were never talking about making low-cost hydrogen for transportation. They were going to make low-cost hydrogen to make money, That's a completely different idea. And that seems to be on the horizon. Anyway, there are critics, very, very learned critic in this case, because he developed an analytical system, an economic system for evaluating what the impact of these new technologies would be on the economics, and advocates purely and simply, let's make electricity. It's a wonderful energy carrier. We know how to use it. And with a little effort and imagination, there's really nothing we can't do with electricity. That's his message. There's one problem with electricity, though. We can't store it. We have to make it and use it. Of course, we can store it in tiny amounts, but we can't store it in the kinds of amounts that we need for a full-blown economy. But there's no problem with hydrogen storage. The other final comment I want to make, and then I'll disappear from here, is that this ocean thermal energy conversion that I mentioned earlier is a very interesting topic in its own right. About $250 million was spent by the U.S., the USSR at that time, and the German governments in learning how to build these reactors at the tropical sea to generate electricity and then use the electricity to make hydrogen, which is the oldest technique for making electricity. You saw that this was a proposal that goes back 150 years. And the resource base in the tropical ocean, just to give you an idea, corresponds roughly to 19 times our total electric generating capacity in the U.S., which is also several times the worldwide capacity. And there is an analysis that was performed by the people who ran this U.S. program. They were from the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University. There's a long encyclopedia article by the person in charge of this, Bill Avery. And he points out that if you build these small ocean-generating stations now, like 50 kilowatts at a time, by the time you get to about the 12th or 13th of those stations, you can make the hydrogen at a cost competitive with fossil fuel costs today. But of course, you're not going to quit after 12 or 13 of these. You're going to continue learning, and you're going to build many, many more. That looks like something that's on the verge of reality. When these programs were phased out of government support, the idea was that a private company would now take over these programs and hopefully build one of these large OTEC, ocean thermal energy conversion systems. That hasn't happened, but it could have happened. And that looks like a marginally competitive idea even today. That's a renewable resource, again, that is used. It's the sun making for the temperature gradients in the ocean. There is a possible environmental flaw here. I think it's a very small one. But when you start mixing up the ocean, as you do inevitably with this ocean thermal energy conversion, you may be liberating some carbon dioxide that is normally located in the ocean. The amounts are probably very small compared to the amounts that you generate with fossil fuels. That needs to be studied, obviously. That is probably the nearest thing to a near-term commercialization of hydrogen for transportation that we know how to do. Avery's idea was, as I suggested earlier, take the hydrogen, convert it into ammonia, then ship the ammonia around, and then burn it in an internal combustion engine. Well, that we won't do. But we can ship it around and burn it in a fuel cell, and there are people who have looked at an ammonia supply for use in a fuel cell, and that looks like a very promising development. Well, I hope I haven't confused you too much with all these ideas. Thank you for your attention.
Appreciate you using the word energy carrier. Too often we hear it as an energy source. Hydrogen is not an energy source.
No.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. No, if it were an energy source, we'd be in business. It's It's 0.9% of the surface of the Earth as far as material goes, but we don't have any hydrogen wells anywhere, and we're not going to have any. That's also for sure.
In the ancient days when I looked at hydrogen very briefly, there seemed to be a problem with containment in, say, steel vessels. Mm-hmm. The hydrogen diffused through very easily. Has that been solved? Or?
Yes, it's been solved as part of the space program because we started to use hydrogen on a large scale in the space program in the 1950s. Remember the F-1 rockets that took us to the moon? They were hydrogen-oxygen rockets. And we learned a great deal about how to manage hydrogen in that connection, and the materials were completely changed for just the reason that you mentioned.
If very cheap electricity from nuclear power were available, you know, a lot of changes in politics, among other things, would that still leave such problems as the transportation of hydrogen in small vehicles that you think it's not likely to happen in the near future?
Well, you're talking like Mr. Shinar now. I mean, that's, of course, his point, that we know how to build nuclear reactors. We can build passively safe nuclear reactors. We can generate electricity at low cost that way. If we don't go overboard on the environmental issues here, I think that we inevitably will return to construction of nuclear reactors on a large scale. I don't think there's much doubt about that. We'll have to do it. The French and the Russians have been doing it, and the Japanese have been doing it, and I think there is only one single reactor currently being designed for construction in the U.S. after an interlude of over 20 years. So I agree with your point. I mean, nuclear reactors ought to be used. We know how to use them. We know how to use them safely. They're clean. There's just no reason not to use them.
I'm interested in your comments about the solar to electricity, solar to hydrogen conversion using the semiconductor device. If that were reduced to a practical device as far as efficiency and so forth, I would suspect that to get a reasonable amount of hydrogen per power economy, you'd be occupying a large fraction of the southwest of the United States with your cells.
Well, that it will require a very large area is certain. However, we have very large areas that are essentially unused, and if you run a photolytic system of that sort, you're really not doing anything to where you have it seated. You're just collecting solar energy.
I suspect, however, that you would run into opposition from the ecologists. Who would suspect that you were modifying the ecology underneath this?
Well, not very much, because you only need something like an 8% conversion efficiency in order to have an economically competitive hydrogen production. I think more important than these local environmentalists going bananas over this is the fact that we are using land that is used for food production now for energy production. And, of course, in that competition, the food production will always come first. So I think your point's well taken. It's a large area for sure.
Thank you for giving us an ocean of interesting ideas and information. Did you give the efficiency of the conversion of electricity to hydrogen or hydrogen to electricity that I missed?
Well, the efficiencies that we have right now are probably in the range of 60%, but we can get much higher efficiencies, we think, and that's a research frontier again, to do the electrolysis at elevated temperature. We may be able to get the cost down that way. That's a current development and research program. I have a view graph showing all this. I don't think I have time to show it, so I'll show it to you privately.
60% going either way?
60% going from electricity to hydrogen.
Yeah. How about hydrogen to electricity?
Well, there would be no point in doing that because, you know, we know how to make electricity.
You mentioned the idea of using...
Well, it would be, if I use the hydrogen in a fuel cell, I can get 100% theoretically. In practice, I will get less. But probably not very much less.
Thank you.
Professor Penner, you said that nuclear energy is clean. Isn't there radioactivity that remains after?
Well, of course, we have to worry about how we dispose of the radioactive materials safely, and that we put the high-level material in safe storage. You know, there have been, I think by now, four studies of NRC committees set up by the national academies. And they've always come to the same conclusion that the high-level waste can be safely stored in geological strata that have been stable for millions of years. I just don't buy that statement. I think we know where to put it and how to put it there safely. I'm that much of a nook.
How about ethanol?
How about what?
Ethanol. The European Common Market actually has a political decision that is actually the cost and the amount of food that is being destroyed just to maintain the price of food is such that economically it makes more sense to use the food to produce ethanol as a source of energy, which is very cheap.
Well, using ethanol is very much locality dependent. As you know, ethanol as a fuel has been used for many years in Brazil, where they grow lots of sugar, and the sugar waste can be converted within their economic system to great advantage to alcohol for fuel use. We've looked at that kind of conversion in the U.S., and it doesn't look very good. It's just not really a competitive system. And if the Europeans think they have a competitive system, they have a much more benign climate than I think they have.